Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast. I'm Jamie Lee Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quit lit authors, and sober heroes. Hi, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Jamie Lee Grace, and we had a great time at our event on Monday. Thank you so much to those of you who were able to come. We didn't have a massive lot of people there, but it didn't matter. It was intimate, and it was just really nice. It was so lovely to meet some people in person who have been listening to the podcast, because, you know, it's a funny thing when you do something like a podcast, you've got absolutely no idea who is listening. And at first it feels as though nobody is listening. And of course you see the download numbers and the figures are really good, but it's hard to imagine that there really is anybody out there. So it was just great to actually meet a few people in person who came up and said, oh yeah, well, I heard about the event because I listened to the podcast. So that was great. And it was a really informative and fun evening. It was just great to have William Porter, author of Alcohol Explained. He's such a vulnerable guy, just you know, no airs and graces, just such a lovely guy. I really, really love William, and or Sam, which is his real name. He writes under a pseudonym. But his story is fascinating, and I don't think he shared it with many people. So if you do get a chance to hear him speak again, or we'll create some kind of little video from the event, but he tells a fabulous story about how he gave up drinking and just really got really quite bored, and then ended up in the army. So be very scared. It might happen to you. Because, you know, let's face it, people have time on their hands, don't they, once they stop drinking. And our other guest, of course, was Laura Willoughby from Club Soda. Club Soda is just an incredible online community. They really do amazing work. And Laura is a real powerhouse. She just does so many things. At the moment, they're working really hard on their Club Soda Guide, which is looking at trying to highlight the pubs and the clubs around the UK that really have a good alternative for people who don't want to drink for whatever reason. So, you know, we don't think it's acceptable anymore just to have a Coke and a lemonade and an orange juice. We want some proper, decent drinks. And of course, there are, you know, there's so much to choose from now. So it's doing a lot of great work with the Club Soda Guide, and also inviting people to share their tips of places that they've found. So if you know somewhere in your area, if you're in the UK, that has some great offerings, then make sure you let them know. And Laura just gave the best example I've heard in ages about how to kind of sum up whether you need to think about your issues with alcohol, because we often talk about how before we stop drinking, so many people Google, am I an alcoholic? Or they Google, is the amount I'm drinking too much? Those kind of questions. And of course, nobody can answer them. And as we've said before on the podcast as well, there are so many different areas of grey when it comes to drinking. There's a whole spectrum, and what might be an issue for one person may not be for another. And certainly when you bring into the equation tolerance and everything, you know, it's a whole spectrum. But Laura has this... She said something that was just so hilarious. She said, I don't want to stop anyone drinking. I'm not here to tell anyone to stop drinking. If you're drinking and you're happy and you're enjoying that, then you go for it. She said, but really, this is Club Soda, and the stuff that we do is for anyone who just knows that they're a dickhead when it comes to alcohol. I thought, that's it. That absolutely sums it up. You know in your heart that your relationship with alcohol, there's something that isn't right. You know, for me, it was the 3 a.m. wake-ups. It's whatever it is for you. And that really is the parameter. And it doesn't matter what stage you're at either. You know, again, some people really are at that dramatic rock bottom. And for others, it really is just that niggling feeling of, you know, something could tip up here. And it really doesn't matter what stage you're at. The sooner you can recognise it and get off the booze elevator, which is that other great phrase, then the better your life will be. I'm still getting responses from the TV thing I did a week and a half ago. on Good Morning Britain. It was a debate about should parents drink. And there's still stuff popping up in the press about it. You know, every time the headline is, you know, woman gets blasted because of views on parents drinking. And then when you actually read the article, just like the first one, I can't say I've been blasted, actually. But it's all good fun. And I suppose the more it gets these topics out into the mainstream, the better. I did actually see just today that Susanna Reid, who was obviously the presenter on Good Morning Britain, who famously said she'd given up alcohol for 9 months. And then on the show that I did, she was kind of on the fence about it. But now it seems, according to one of the papers today, online papers today, that she has gone back to drinking. She claims that Piers Morgan drove her to it. So, yeah. There you go. I reckon she just needs to, she needs some connection. That's what she needs. I really think that is, you know, the key. I think that it's really hard to do this on your own because of our culture, because of our society. It's almost impossible just to make the decision and then try and do it yourself. You know, one thing that I've thought about a lot, you know, since I've stopped drinking is, well, something that I've been thinking about for years, because something, you know, very much connected to the work that I do. But the power of the mind, the role of our thoughts in what we do. And we know that our thoughts create our reality and create effectively what happens to us. And we know that we have this kind of cycle. We have a thought and then a feeling, and then that leads to action. So, you know, our thoughts create our feelings. We have a thought, and then we have a certain way of feeling about that, an emotion connected to the thought. And it's the emotion that then decides to drive the action. So, you know, it's very common, of course, you to have a thought, I need a glass of wine, or, you know, I need a beer, I've had a stressful day, I need a cold beer, which leads to the emotion of really desiring and feeling that we deserve that cold beer or wine or whatever it is. And then that drives the action, which, you know, if we can't have it, then we become petulant and start to crave it. So what we can often do in that situation is just go straight and pour the beer. And because that's what we always do, it's a cycle and it becomes a habit. And then, of course, our brain, our subconscious mind, which is very clever and wants to look after us and protect us, recognises that this is what we do. You know, when we feel stressed or a bit fed up or well, actually anything. It can be anything, can't it? It can be happy or sad. It can be just because it's a Tuesday we drink. But our brain knows that as soon as those thoughts come in, that leads to the feeling of, oh, wouldn't it be nice? Oh, I desire that. Or I'm worth it. Or, you know, I deserve it. Which leads to that action. So our brain, our subconscious mind, tries to remind us that that's a really good idea. And of course, some people have got the addictive voice. They've got this little voice in their head. One of the podcast guests, Belle, from Tired of Thinking About Drinking, she calls this voice Wolfie. She has an actual name for the voice. Some people call it the wine witch. But if you do have that voice, that is the voice that says, go on, you know, just have one. One won't hurt you. Start tomorrow. Decide to give up tomorrow or next month or wait till January or whatever it might be. And this is because our subconscious mind is really good at just keeping us doing what we've always done, because that feels safe, and we know that that's our pattern. And of course, it doesn't have it doesn't know right from wrong, so it's not gonna help us have the debate about whether this is a good idea. Where am I going with this? Yeah, so my point is, it should be easy then, shouldn't it? Because we should be able to just say to ourselves, well, okay, then I'll change my thoughts. I'll think something different. I'll think I won't drink. I'll decide not to drink. But that's really, really tough on your own without support. And I think one of the things, certainly at the beginning of the journey, that helps you do that, that helps you change those thoughts before you even get into, you know, deep into the feelings and the actions, to help you change the thoughts, you need to immerse yourself in other people's stories, in inspiration, in knowledge. And that was what made the difference for me. I've tried lots of times. I've made the decision lots of times. I will think differently about alcohol. I will think I am not going to drink. And then, you know, by 6 o'clock, the wine witch is on your shoulder and you're having a drink. But once I realised this thing that I'm always talking about, that there is a whole world out there and that life is so much better on the other side. Once I got a glimpse of that, just the tiniest glimpse, once I connected to it and started to see and hear and find out more about that, suddenly I had more fuel, if you like. I was able to give myself different thoughts because I was literally reading stuff that I hadn't considered before. I was reading other people's stories. I was reading The Unexpected Joy of Being Sober and The Sober Diaries and some of these fantastic books where I was reading about people going through similar experiences to me and coming out the other side. I was also part of communities where, even though I didn't necessarily contribute much, I was reading other people's stories. And interestingly, when you read about someone relapsing or whatever expression you want to use, basically someone ends up going back to day one, you feel a huge amount of empathy and it changes your thoughts because you're there with them. But a little bit of you is thinking, wow, that's a warning for me. I really do believe immersing yourself in this connection is the key. It's the answer. And I think that's the bit that the people like Susanna, bless her, I don't suppose she's listening. And I think that's the bit she didn't do. That's the bit she missed. And so, here's hoping that she will find some books or a podcast or whatever resonates for her, an event. I've written an article actually for Alcohol Change UK. They've got a great website and they feature a lot of really good blogs, and I was delighted to be able to contribute. And I've done a piece there about celebs and FOMA, F-O-M-A, fear of missing alcohol, because that is how it feels. That's exactly how it feels, that real fear of missing out, until you can reframe it, until you can change your mindset, literally change your thoughts so that you don't feel the same desire. I know this feels impossible, actually, and I could never have imagined saying it even a year ago. So you're just going to have to trust me on that one. I don't know how long it takes. It takes different time for everyone. But I was talking about this with someone at the event, actually, and we were saying it's absolutely incredible when you do get to the stage where you can be at a function or a party or somewhere where there normally would have been a real kind of trigger for you, and you can actually look at the table full of drinks and think, you know what, I don't desire that at all. I actually have no desire for that. It's very cool. It's really good. So our next event for anyone who can make it is actually really quite close. It's a Monday, May the 20th. So I hope we've got enough time to entice some of you to be able to come. It is free. We've got fantastic guests. We've got a guest who was on the podcast a few weeks ago, Elsa Frank, who is a hypnotherapist, incredible behavioral change expert. She's written a great book, Cut the Crap and Feel Amazing. And she's worked for many years with people with all kinds of issues, as well as addictions. And so she's got some great insights into hypnosis, how you can train yourself. She has some amazing downloads. So I think that's going to be a really interesting conversation with Elsa. And also Dr. Richard Piper from Alcohol Change UK. And he's kind of Mr. Dry January, really, and got some great insights again into what's going on, particularly in the UK, of course. Great guests. We're going to have juices and shots and stuff. And as I say, it's free. You do need to sign up via Eventbrite. So if you just type in self-care for the sober curious, or you can type in the charity name, which is My Yard, the charity host, all of this. It's in London. So that's Monday, May the 20th. It would be so great to meet more of you podcast listeners. So come if you can. Now, I mentioned in that long ramble about the fact that people really really vary in where they're at on the spectrum of drinking, on the shades of grey, if you like. And my guest on the podcast today is from the US. It's the first time I've had someone from the States. And she has really done a lot of work around this. And she's an author. And the book is called Raising the Bottom. And just great title, because, you know, her message is we do not have to wait till we get rock bottom. And it's a great message. And she's she has a very different take on things to a lot of my podcast guests. So it's really good to get a different insight. I really hope you'll enjoy the interview. The book is Raising the Bottom. And my guest is Lisa Boucher. It's lovely to have a guest from the other side of the world, well, from the States anyway. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you, Janie. I'm happy to be with you.
Yeah, it's really good to talk to you. I love just kind of making connections with people who are, you know, a distance away, but we've got some shared experiences. Now, the book Raising the Bottom, Making Mindful Choices in a Drinking Culture. Tell us a little bit about how that came about. Maybe a bit about your background first, because you've done some interesting jobs, let's put it that way.
Oh, yeah, it's been a ride, Janie. So I got interested in all of this because my mother was an alcoholic. So I grew up in a very chaotic, crazy home. My mother was an RN. My dad was a businessman. It seemed very normal on the outside. But she got addicted to the pharmaceutical industry's first billion-dollar drug, which was Valium. And that started a 25-year trajectory of addiction for her. And then it escalated to alcohol. So I found recovery early in my 20s after watching what happened to my mother, hit a very low bottom, break her neck. I mean, it was a montage of insanity. Mm. And so I write about all of this, but I wanted to focus on when I got sober, when most people, even my husband, was saying, you're not an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that, you know what I'm saying? I wanted to focus on the only piece of addiction that I feel, even globally, that we focus on is the tail end of addiction.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And why do we have to go there? We don't. So sure. That is my message, yeah. Right?
I mean, absolutely. No, I love that. I mean, it's something I talk about all the time, because I often make jokes about how the fact that I am also high bottomed. Oh, we wish.
Well,
but, you know, you're absolutely right. But Lisa, just backtrack a moment and just tell us a little bit about, I mean, there'll be people thinking, okay, well, if you saw that with your mother, in a sense, was it a given that you were also going to drink? Or wasn't there a time when you thought, you know what, I don't want to end up like that? Tell us a bit about how drinking started for you and then some of the jobs you did along the way.
All right. Well, I don't think it occurred to me to connect her drinking with what I was doing. And I talk about this in my book. We were living like these parallel universe where she's in her alcoholism. And as a teenager, I had my first beer when I was 12 years old.
Wow.
Behind the Jewish Community Center. I will never forget it. And I started smoking pot. Mm. With friends. We used to go there. I'm not Jewish, but we'd go there anyway because they had games and a pool and whatnot. And so that started where I think I was self-medicating. When you grow up, my father was a very angry, I think he couldn't handle the environment. I mean, he couldn't control my mother. He couldn't control her addiction. He didn't really, they sought help for her. But he was getting, you know how they say in addiction, the family gets sicker. Mm. And my father was. He was just, you know, sometimes violent. He was physically abusive to us kids sometimes, the screaming, the yelling. So I think I started early just to kind of escape. And I had two older sisters and they're drinking. So it just kind of happened like that.
Right. Yeah. And then tell us about some of the work that you did, because I've read that you were you're a flight attendant for a while, a hairdresser, but you also worked in hospitals.
Yes. Yes. So I did. I used to train horses. I mean, I'm a horse nut and I think that saved me. I think all that time outdoors, I was a hairdresser, a flight attendant. all of these numerous jobs, all the while going to school, though. So I was in my, as you spend a decade in your undergrad, and that was one of my early symptoms of alcoholism. Like, why am I not graduating? My friends are graduating. They're moving on with their lives, and I'm still changing majors and flitting around. So I never really finished my degree at that point. And then when I got sober is when I realized I had amassed an enormous amount of credits that were basically useless. And so, you know, the reality of I had an early sobriety. I found out I was, let's back up. I got sober in April of 89, stayed sober 3 months, had a 1 day relapse, then stayed sober since then. Right. However, somewhere in there, I got pregnant with twins. So in my early recovery, I'm pregnant with twins and I'm trying to get sober. And then I have these babies. And then I realize, oh my God, if something happens in our marriage, I have no way of supporting these children. So I went to nursing school. And I did finish nursing school. And I graduated valedictorian of my class. And that just shows you how drinking was impeding any progress, you know, prior to that, when you're spending 10 years in school.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I've been, you know, a nurse for a long time now.
Sure. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But so I'm really interested to know then what was the catalyst then for you to, as you say, decide to get sober? We know you didn't hit, in inverted commas, rock bottom. So what was the change for you? When did you realize that things needed to change?
It was an emotional bottom. It was a spiritual bankruptcy. It was the inability to regulate my emotions, drinking and then crying, drinking, then arguing, drinking, then being overly happy. I mean, it was like this roller coaster of emotions. And there were a few things. I mean, I kind of had set parameters. And by this time, my mother is in sobriety and she's starting to chirp in my ear. I was living in Dallas at one point and sitting on the balcony and I popped a beer and it was like 10 in the morning. And she said something to me like, "That's not normal, Lisa. It's 10 o'clock. And I'm like, "Well, I've been up since 5. She was starting to point out little things. And then, like I said, my emotions were all over the place. I'm running with a crowd that is drinking heavily. And I start surveying the crowd. I think that's an early warning sign when you start asking people, "Do I drink too much?" Because this little voice in your head is asking you, I think you're drinking too much. Yeah. So I started to have, you know, things like that. And then I was on another podcast and I was telling one of the other things that really was like cold water on my face is I was working in marketing. I used to write advertising and buy media for a hotel management company. And I worked downtown in the city where I live. And so I had my own little home bar. Well, most people don't have a home bar that aren't problem drinkers. So I walked over to this home bar thinking it's lunchtime because I had gotten used to having a beer or a cocktail at lunch. And I'm frantically pulling on the door of this bar and it's not open. And then I look at my watch and it's 10:30 in the morning. And that struck me at my core that, wow, what is that about? I mean, I didn't quit drinking for another 4 years, don't get me wrong. But, you know, those sorts of things. And then finally, I think that the final straw was my husband said to me, "There's something wrong with you. You need to get your act together," in so many words. And I knew, I mean, because all of these things and the drinking was starting to really escalate. And even though I wasn't a daily drinker when I quit, and I think that's important for people out there that think you have to drink every day and hide bottles before you have a problem. And that's just not true because it's easily disguised in your 20s. You know, everybody's drinking heavily. I didn't have my children. So it seemed very normal, I guess, in quotes. But when it was affecting me in such an adverse way emotionally and my inability to really hold it together was a huge red flag that alcohol is a problem.
And what path did you take then at the beginning? How did you go about getting sober then?
I jumped into a 12-step program. I mean, I had seen that work very, very extremely well. I mean, if you would have seen my mother when she, by the time she got sober, as I mentioned, and I talk all about this in Raising the Bottom, but she had broken her neck. She fell down the steps. Gosh. And she ends up with, you know, the halo and screws drilled into her head. And she went to rehab, and then she went to meetings, and she started to transform unlike anything that touched her for the past 25 years prior, when she had been going to doctors and therapists and the Cleveland Clinic and going all over trying to find help. And all they did is throw medication at her. So I knew I'm not going the doctor route, and working in healthcare now, I think it's disastrous. So I knew I didn't want to do that. And I really didn't know any other option. I know there are some other options now. They really weren't available. It'll be almost 30 years. So I jumped into recovery, and it's worked for me. I love it. And, you know, the relationships that I've made are priceless. And so that's what worked for me.
Okay. And just on that note then, because I you know, it's interesting for me. I haven't actually interviewed anybody else on the podcast yet who's you know, working with 12-step program. If it's all those years on, do you still consider that you are, you know, this phrase in recovery?
Well, you know, people, yes, I do, because I see what happens. By going to meetings, you find out what happens to, there are people out there, and I can go on and give you many, many instances of people that were sober 11 years without doing anything, they relapse. People, even in the program, that were sober 25 years and relapse. What did they stop doing? They stopped going to meetings. They stopped interacting with a sober community. They stopped working the steps. They stopped doing all of the things that helped them get sober. So, you know, I go back, I go now because there were people there for me. And those of us that rack up sobriety and then jet out the door, where does that leave the newcomers that are new trying to get sober? So I feel a sense of obligation. And it's I'm grateful to do it, and I'm happy to do it. And I do work with a lot of women and, you know, their sobriety, because people were there for me. So why wouldn't I keep going?
Sure. And I'm really interested, too, in you know, you mentioned the solutions, or in inverted commas, offered by the traditional healthcare. Now, I mean, in the UK, it's a mess. It really is a mess, because I mean, as we're already touching in this interview on the fact that it seems in society that there are two types of people. You know, one is an alcoholic and they're absolutely down there in the gutter, rock bottom, and everybody else is perfectly fine. And in fact, if you go to your GP, your doctor in the UK, and you say you're worried about your drinking, the likelihood is they'll say, oh, it seems fine to me. Partly because you're probably fibbing. I mean, you're probably going to tell a lie. Let's face it, most people do.
Right.
But also probably because they're also drinking. So, you know, if you basically go along and say, listen, I'm concerned. I mean, exactly what we're talking about here. The fact that your message is you do not have to hit rock bottom. You know, you don't even have to be, you know, drinking every day. If it's affecting you in a negative way, emotionally or whatever way, then look at it. You know, I know that's your message. Right. And if you and I mean, I know for myself, if you rock up to a GP, it may be that you add on to the end of whatever you've allegedly come about. Oh, and by the way, you know, I'm a bit concerned. I think I might be drinking too much. The likelihood is they'll say, well, how much are you drinking? And most people probably lie and say, well, you know, kind of half a bottle a night or whatever. And they'll go, well, that seems perfectly fine.
Right. It's like, what, do they prescribe medicine, though? That's what they tend to do here.
You know, it's not my personal experience, but I think there is some medication that can be offered. But I think in many cases, the holistic solution, if you like, is very poor. There isn't a lot of joined up thinking around it all, if you see what I mean. And I think a lot of people are left feeling really very lonely until they find their own support network, whether that be AA or one of the online communities or whatever. I mean, I'm just interested to know if it's the same in the States. I know your system is different.
Yeah, Janie, it's terrible here. And there's a couple of problems why it's terrible here. Number one, the doctors are not educated in addiction and recovery, nor do they have a will to learn about it. I can tell you when I worked in the emergency room, and you know, alcoholics and drug addicts are most or 80% of what's pouring through the door in some form, whether their liver's going out, an accident, heart failure, most of it can be related back to lifestyle, diabetes, alcohol. Those are two huge health problems. And, you know, I was in recovery at the time, but to listen to some of the staff it speak in such derogatory remarks about it is disheartening. Now, with that said, I get why it gets exhausting as being an RN in an ER and you're exhausted. You realize like, oh my God, it does get tiresome because a lot of time it's the same people over and over. So I do see both sides, but that's one of the problems. The doctors have no will to learn. Number two is medical staff that I've worked with in several hospitals that, like you just said, Janie, they drink heavily themselves. So they don't want to look at it. I have four doctors in my book, and one of the doctors was chief of staff who eventually ended up in his own ED with a fentanyl patch in his mouth. So we have addiction among people in the medical field. I mean, I've got several doctors who tell their story. These were doctors that are still practicing and they're still practicing today. And they flat out said, we knew nothing about alcoholism. We knew nothing about it. We didn't recognize it in our patients unless their liver enzymes were off the chart. That right there is atrocious. My nephew is dating a woman in medical school now. I asked her just a month or so ago, what are you guys learning about addiction? She said nothing. So it's a shame.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I talk about a lot is the fact that certainly in the UK, doctors have little or no training. In their 7 years, they have little or no training in nutrition, you know, for starters. So, you know, there's your problem right there. No training in nutrition and probably very little training in addiction. And you've kind of covered everything, really, haven't you?
I mean, it's true because there's no money in wellness, like doing holistic things. And the other thing is people have to take some personal accountability to make these lifestyle changes that, you know, are difficult to make. That there's no, I mean, they are. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. To change your life, change your diet, start exercising, stop drinking. Those are hard things to do, but we can't keep looking for a pill to fix it. I mean, here in the States, I mean, they spend billions and billions. I think it was $421 billion on prescriptions. That's what people spent in 2016. It's a medicated society.
And
it's shameful, you know. It's not helping.
It's very interesting that, you know, you talk about the fact that that doctors know nothing about it, and because we know that our culture's completely normalized drinking alcohol. It's everywhere. In the UK, it's everywhere. It doesn't matter what you go, you know, whether you're going to a play date or a football match or a cinema. It doesn't matter what it is. There's alcohol is everywhere. And yet, bizarrely, most of us, well, certainly I didn't realize just how addictive alcohol is. We think it's the person. You know, even doctors, I just don't think they realize it. I mean, are you of the view that if alcohol was coming onto the market now, it probably wouldn't even get passed as a legal, you know, substance?
Well, I wish that were the case, but I think because of the vast amounts of money to be made, it's, you know, there's just no hope in prohibition type thing. You know, and there are the people that can do it, but I think it is the big alcohol that, like you just said, Janie, it's interjected now into every aspect of life, and it didn't used to be that way. I mean, I think it's, and I don't care. I just do not agree with mixing parenting and alcohol because children, I was one of those kids and we all suffered mightily because of the alcohol. And back in those days, like with my mom, it wasn't even chic to be drinking on play dates. Now they think it's okay. And then they're going to get in the car and drive their babies home. Like, there is such a disconnect in what is okay. It's, I mean, we have lowered the bar down to snake belly size on some of this stuff. It makes no sense whatsoever to encourage that kind of behavior. But yet young women especially encourage each other to drink. And their children are suffering because nobody would choose to have a boozy mom.
Absolutely. I remember it was just a couple of months ago in the UK, there was an article. I forget the name of the author, but there was a journalist who wrote a piece about her, how traumatic her upbringing was because her mother was an alcoholic. You know, a little similar to your story. It was a very moving piece, and she wrote about this. And then this was followed up by another columnist, basically writing. I'm paraphrasing massively, but the essence of it was this other journalist sort of came on board and said, made a comment in the same newspaper about how, you know, well, yes, I'm sure it was terrible for her. But let's face it, you know, I totally disagree. What mother could possibly do this parenting job, you know, without the booze? It was shocking. It was absolutely shocking. And it kind of broke my heart a little bit because, you know, yes, parenting's hard. Yes, it's tough when your kids are little. But when the message everywhere is, you know, what's that awful phrase? Baby on the hips, wine on the lips. I mean, my goodness.
Yeah.
It's frightening, isn't it? Frightening.
It is frightening. And you know, and that's how we are. We're almost cultivating addiction in our society by people like him and not understanding the connection between a traumatic childhood and later addiction. You can't go to a rehab anywhere and ask and do your own little survey. 80% of the people, I guarantee you, have had some sort of trauma in their life, if that being living with an alcoholic parent or a drug addicted parent. There's a lot of trauma in that for children. And so we cultivate addiction. And then those people, like myself, we grow up, alcohol's everywhere, and we just continue on with self-medicating.
Yeah. It's very interesting as well that you initially we spoke about the issue, the being rock bottom, or what it was that started you on the sober path. And I like the phrase you used where you said, you know, you hit emotional rock bottom. And I think that's just such an important factor here, because everybody thinks about the physical side of alcohol addiction and, you know, being a mess and being overweight and looking terrible or whatever it is and having a hangover. But very few people, at least, you know, in my frame of reference originally, talk about the mental health issues. And yet we know that there's a massive link, isn't there, between mental health issues and alcoholism. I mean, it they're almost intrinsically linked. So we don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg or whatever.
Well, you're absolutely right. I think most of it is mental health, but nobody wants to look at it early on. You know, they want to wait until the body and everything breaks down. And like I said, nobody thought I was an alcoholic then, but these emotional bottoms are devastating. And then what happens is women, I see it all the time, still working a few days a week in the hospital. They come in and then they complain of depression and anxiety and they get medicated and then they get remedicated. And really the whole problem is the underlying substance abuse, but it's never addressed, you know. And if you're someone, I want to throw this out there, if you're someone who suffers from depression and you're still drinking, it doesn't make sense. Why would you go to the doctor, take antidepressants, and then drink a depressant?
Yeah.
See what I'm saying? It's that disconnect there that people aren't tying the knot together and realizing, like, okay, my own behavior is self-sabotaging what I'm running to the doctor trying to cure.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So what's your advice to people then? What are your tips, if you like? Because, you know, as we both know, when you first make this decision, when you have this realization, it's not as straightforward, is it, as just going, oh, I won't have another one then.
You know, right.
It's tough at the beginning. I mean, my podcast is all about self-care and positivity and how life is better without alcohol. I really want to focus on those gains rather than the giving up. But as you say, we can't completely sugarcoat it. It is a rough ride at the beginning, and
And it is an addictive substance. So it's not as straightforward as you might think to just simply make the decision, okay, won't have any more. So how did you ease yourself into that? And what would you recommend for people having this thought right now?
Well, I would recommend, I think everybody knows somebody who's sober probably by now. So I would start there, that
get
if
some
you're
support.
Having these, right, if you're having these conversations, like we were saying earlier, and you start to question your drinking, that is your conscience, your soul speaking to you. Listen to it and at least start exploring some and trying to relate to some of the feelings from the sober people. If you don't know anyone who's sober, get online. My God, there is so much information out there now, and listen to podcasts such as yours and start to educate yourself. And the more you educate yourself about how alcoholism is on a bell curve and you don't have to make it to the end and all of these things, I think it makes it easier to start to consider the maybe, I like to say. Be open to considering the maybe. You don't have to make a decision that day. Like, okay, like you said, I'm alcoholic and I'm just going to stop. And I think people struggle with that word alcoholic. So take that out of the equation. If that's going to trip you up, I know I couldn't choke it out for 2 months sitting in meetings. And then I finally got okay with it. So, you know, say you're a problem drinker, whatever works for you, start getting honest. I mean, I think that's the biggest hurdle to recovery is the denial, which is a hallmark sign of the disease, and also the dishonesty of how we can rationalize just about anything. So that horrible drunk that you had, well, that was just that one night, but when reality is it's happened 3 times this month already. So those kinds of things is, you know, and if you need to write it down, because sometimes we can be a little more honest on paper than we can just saying it to someone. So start tracking, you know, how much are you really drinking? How much are you getting? Are you having blackouts? If you're having blackouts, you've crossed into alcoholism. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Normal social drinkers do not have blackouts.
Yeah.
Because that means you don't have an off button. And you know what I'm saying? I mean, an off button is, okay, I've had a few glasses of wine. I like the buzz. I feel mellow. I'm good. That's what social drinkers do.
Yeah.
But somebody with a problem is going to black out. So I think it's really important to be honest. And the third really important thing is to not compare yourself.
Yeah.
Because I almost compared myself out of the rooms, because it's not really determinant upon quantity. You can't say, well, if you don't drink X amount, then you don't have a problem. I mean, you don't know. All of our physiology is so very different. So what is okay for you may not be okay for me. So there again, we have to look at ourselves as individuals and not compare ourselves to other people in order to justify what we're doing. So that's another tip. The third, you know, last one that really comes to mind is pay attention to your activities.
Yeah.
Are you horrified at the thought of going somewhere where they don't serve alcohol? Is that like, oh, heck no, I'm not going to that party or that event if there's no booze? That's another sign. You know, a normal social drinker is pretty open to doing all sorts of things and having a well-rounded life and trying new things, even if booze isn't available.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, you know, the next kind of hurdle that people usually face is other people. You know, there's so much hassle with other individuals, you know, who say to you, oh, go on, just have one, you know, oh, you've got a terrible problem. And I mean, we say it a lot on this podcast, but, you know, you give up smoking, people congratulate you, but you give up drinking and people say, oh, dear, it must have been terrible for you. can't you just have one?
Why is that?
It's bizarre, isn't it?
Well, it is. I'm saying the fact that we've, like, adults have to succumb to this other adult peer pressure.
We have to justify ourselves effectively.
That's what I'm exactly. I mean, I can tell you in my recovery, I don't know about you, but the only people who've ever really questioned my drinking were people who had problems themselves. And one of those guys took his own life. Another one got into recovery. I don't know what happened to the other one, but these people would not take no for an answer. I remember being on a boat and he offered us an alcohol and I said, no, thank you. Then out came the joints. I said, no, thank you. He said, you want some lines? You want to do a few lines? No, thank you. That is a gentleman that ended up taking his own life. So I think people are, when they're uncomfortable with someone who is not drinking, there's a good sign right there that they have a problem because normal social drinkers aren't going to feel uncomfortable having a glass of wine or a drink in front of somebody who's not drinking because it's just not a big issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And finally then, Lisa, what about self-care? You know, it's become a very, you know, big buzzword, but I really do think that so many of us have actually forgotten how to take care of ourselves, and particularly for women who have been spending, you know, they've been just boozing the whole time and most of their extra energy has gone on trying to, in inverted commas, relax with wine or whatever it is. And suddenly when the drink's taken away, they actually don't know how to look after themselves very, very, very well. So I'm all for kind of encouraging people to do, even if it's very small things, just to sort of put an actual treat in your life. I mean, I used to think of my wine as a treat. Of course, I now realize it wasn't a treat at all. It was poison. But now I've got to actually do something that does feel like a treat, whether that's a, I don't know, have a bath with a candlelit bath or go for a walk. So these little things, I mean, what's your experience of that, particularly with the women that you work with?
Well, I encourage them to carve out even 15 minutes a day for themselves, because a lot of the women that are getting sober, they're working, they have children. So like you said, take a walk. There's some great apps out there with meditation and whatnot that you can do 5, 10, 15 minutes. Start doing that on a regular basis where you just sit quietly. Mm. Nature is, I think, amazing. And they have proven that the trees give off, it's called phytosines, and it's a chemical that improves immunity, decreases depression. Animals, I find so much therapy in spending time around, you know, whether you have a pet or if you live near somewhere where there's horses or goats or whatever. I think animals are just, it gets you out of yourself. Find a, you know, start gardening. You can do little windowsill gardening. I know in the UK, sometimes it's cold and it's rainy like it is here a lot, but you can bring the outdoors in. Mm-hmm. And I think creating a space in your house, however small, can be so nurturing, where you have things that are special, and rather that's a cozy blanket or afghan or shawl, or like you said, some scented candles, and get some, you know, nice things that remind you of nature to lift your spirits, and just like, this is my space, whatever makes you happy, do that. I mean, and eat chocolate, you know, especially in early recovery, we crave sugar.
Yeah, we do.
And I think giving ourselves the permission to not worry about it if you gain 5 pounds, because you'll probably lose a lot of weight because you're not drinking all those calories, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it's also important not to compare in a different sense your life with someone else's, because that always makes people feel bad. So if you stop comparing, look what they have, or look how happy they are, or look what they're doing, find your own routine niche that works for you. And you know, lastly, go buy yourself a pair of fabulous shoes. I think that is a treat that everybody deserves. You know, if you're sober, you're gonna want to start skipping soon. Get a pair of shoes that just makes you smile.
Well, yeah, I mean, I remember at the beginning, I so wish I'd done it, but somebody gave me a tip a little way down the line that said, just every single penny that you would have spent on the booze, which of course adds up, you know, put it aside in a jar and then treat yourself, because it's amazing how that money will rack up.
You know,
you're saving
away.
Money. Yeah.
Well, even to give yourself the treat of a little day trip away,
exactly.
You know,
yeah.
somewhere. I mean, you can treat yourself well, inexpensively, and just making a point of carving out the time to do it.
Sure. So, Lisa, how many years have you been sober?
29. It'll be
wow.
30 in June.
Wow.
30 in June 22nd. Yeah, wow. I can't believe it, actually.
It's amazing. Do you still, well, celebrate's not the right word, but I mean, I guess obviously you're because you're an author, you've written this book and you're working sort of in this environment. Obviously you do, you know, think about it. Of course you do. But I mean, how important does it become as the years go by? Do you still kind of mark the date every year? I wonder about that.
I celebrate my anniversary for
do
sure,
you?
My yearly anniversary.
Wow.
I do, yeah. I get a chip and my sponsor usually gives it to me. And this year, quite frankly, I'm having a party at my house.
Wow.
I'm going to do an open house
wow.
because I feel like 30 years, I've never done that before. I don't really, you know, celebrate in a huge, huge way. But this year feels special to me.
Mm.
I cannot believe so much time has passed
mm.
one day at a time. And, you know, there is such a difference between being sober and being dry because
mm.
I would have never made it this far if I was still white knuckling it
yeah.
or if I still thought of alcohol every day. I mean, every once in a while, like I said, I live with a drinker. So, and on holidays, my family, they drink a lot, sadly,
mm.
but they
mm.
do. You know, or we're out to dinner and you see someone with a glass of wine. I'd be lying if I said it. There are times when I'm like, oh, that looks really good.
Mm.
But then I'm done. That thought passes and I move on to something else because I know for me, it's not going to end there. And so
mm.
I have to play the tape all the way forward to what does it look like for Lisa Boucher? And for Lisa Boucher, it doesn't look like fun at the end.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, it's just not worth it.
Yeah, no, I get that. And just one other question. You know, we mentioned these social drinkers, we call them, you know, normies is sometimes the phrase, you know, the kind of people that can have, you know, a drink or two and then actually not think about it. You know, they do have an off switch. There are some people like that, as we know. But in your experience or in your opinion, because alcohol is what it is an addictive substance in and of itself. Do you think that there is a propensity, if you like, in everyone so that, let's say, you know, God forbid, there's some crisis in that person's life that the off switch might disappear? I'm not sure how, if I'm phrasing the question right.
No,
but
I understand,
you know,
what you're saying. And I think that is such a it's very, I mean, alcoholism is a complicated disease. So I think that's possible if you have, but, you know, I think there's a genetic component, environmental. I do know grief triggers a lot of people into alcoholism and things, crisis can trigger people. But with that said, I think in most cases, they had the propensity, whether it be genetically or some other link. I know there are people that have a crisis. They might drink heavily for a week or two and then they snap right out of it.
Mm.
Where somebody who has the propensity to alcoholism is going to keep going. And I think even in society with all the drinking, the more we practice anything, the better we get at it, right? You're just playing with fire, even if you don't have a genetic link that you're aware of.
Yeah.
But if you practice drinking every day, you're probably going to end up an alcoholic because it's your body is just going to start to build a tolerance regardless.
Mm. Yeah.
So I just think it's playing with fire.
Mm. Gosh, we could talk for ages.
Yes,
the book is Raising the Bottom, Making Mindful Choices in a Drinking Culture. So do you want to tell us where people can find out more about you, Lisa?
Well, over in the UK, I think you're going to have to hop on Amazon is probably the best bet. Yeah, here in the States, it's in select bookstores and on Barnes & Noble and, you know, Target, Walmart and other websites. But over there, you might have to stick with Amazon.
Yeah,
I hope you'll get it.
And just tell us your website then, Lisa?
RaisingTheBottom.com.
Excellent. Lisa, thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast. I really appreciate
Jamie,
thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
So I hope you enjoyed that interview and you can grab yourself a copy of Lisa's book. Coming up on the podcast over the next few weeks, I've got some great guests lined up. I'm going to be interviewing Matt Smith, who is a sports broadcaster and journalist. He was with TalkSport. So he's got some really interesting stories to tell, his take on how alcohol fits in with the whole sporting culture in the UK, if you like. So that's going to be really interesting. I've also got an interview with Harriet Whaley-Cohen. I think I've mentioned that to you before. Harriet's a coach. And she's really skilled in nutrition and a whole bunch of things. So really, really nice interview with Harriet. We're going to look forward to bringing you that as well. And also, I haven't mentioned this before, but I think ages ago I did pitch out and say, look, if there's any listeners who have a story they'd love to contribute, love to share, then please do get in touch. And to that end, I'm going to be interviewing Sober Dave, who many people know from Instagram, who came along to our event last week. It's got a great story. So I'm really looking forward to sharing that with you. And Patchwork Recovery, I think, is the Instagram name from Ireland. So, couple of guys I'm going to line up. So some really interesting guests, as well as, of course, the bigger names. Jolene Park, I'm hoping to interview as well. So, and feel free, of course, to share your story with me or drop me an email or let me know if there's someone you would like me to interview. You know, someone you've heard about and you'd like me to get on the podcast. I can only try, you know, it's worth a shot, isn't it? So this week's self-care tip, I'm going to suggest actually that you dare yourself or you challenge yourself. I was thinking about this, that we do tend to get into a rut, a lot of us. you know, it can just be the same thing we do all of the time. And, you know, when we're kids, we dare ourselves a lot, don't we? We take a lot of risks. I'm not suggesting that you do anything necessarily risky, although you might want to. But sometimes just the act of giving yourself a challenge, you know, going to something that you don't necessarily feel, you know, you just feel nervous about it, meeting somebody, whatever it might be. So it might be something really small for you, but that is an act of self-care. You know, self-care isn't always just sort of having a bath or going for a walk. It's also recognizing what it is you need to stretch yourself a little bit to just get a little bit out of your comfort zone. So the self-care tip is very broad this week. It's absolutely whatever you choose that you know will set you just a little bit out of your comfort zone. And that might be something really small, like taking a different route to work or getting a different bus or whatever it is. Or it might be something really big. Maybe you'll decide to book yourself in for a parachute jump, whatever. But dare yourself, and I'll be delighted to know what you did and how it worked out if you want to share that with me. Just yet another reminder for the event. It's Self-Care for the Sober Curious. It's Monday 20th. It's at the JGO in London. You do need to sign up for your free tickets via Eventbrite. And don't forget, you can find me on social media at Janie Lee Grace. And you can drop me an email, janie@janieleegrace.com. I'll see you same time next week. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast with Janie Lee Grace. Please subscribe to us on iTunes, rate us, share on social media, and tune in again.